from a recording entitled The Poetry of Jazz, Volume 2. That was Benjamin Boone and Philip Levine. The track is Let Me Begin Again. I talked with Benjamin Boone, a former UT professor and music student here at the University of Tennessee, via an ISDN line all the way to Fresno, California. Here's that interview. You're listening to Improvisations, and it is my distinct pleasure to talk with Benjamin Boone, who has a new recording out. It's called The Poetry of Jazz, Volume 2. It's obviously a sequel to the very successful Volume 1. Benjamin Boone, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, hey, Todd. Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to talk on the radio station that I listened to voraciously when I was a student there, 82 to 87, and then teaching there, 97 to 2000. It's a blast from the past.
Yeah, and I remember you from when you were here, and we obviously have a lot of mutual friends, and you're now in Fresno, California.
I am. Imagine that. And I took a rather circuitous route to get here. I think my wife and I figured we have moved 14 places. But what landed me in Fresno was a job at California State University Fresno, where I'm a professor of music theory, music composition, and I'm having a great time.
And it's at that very university where you met Phil Levine.
It absolutely is. And I had actually heard about Philip before I took the job. One of my writer friends, Danny Fultzgray, who was taught at Roan State for a long time, when I asked him about Cal State Fresno, he said, oh, my favorite poet ever lives there right now, and they've kept him, so it must be a good place. So I had checked out Philip's poetry, learned he won the Pulitzer Prize, all of these other awards, and I thought, wow, if they can have someone like that on campus, maybe it's a place I want to apply. And so the rest is led to the making of these CDs.
I think anytime you combine poetry and jazz, I mean, there's always a good chance it'll work, but I always feel there's also a pretty good chance it won't work. This one really worked.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I appreciate that so much. And, you know, a lot of other people will say, well, what poetry and jazz things inspired me? And, I mean, there are some great ones. There's Jan Iyer Blum has a thing out. Sung has something out. You know, different people, right? And they work. But when I thought about doing the CDs, we had done some things live, and I was really thinking about, well, how do I want to do it? What makes it work? And so I listened to what had been done in the past, and it's, you know, a lot of it's really cool and really interesting, but not for a whole CD, right? Not for me personally. So I think I approached it a little bit differently than other people did. So the synopsis would be, with my concept, was simply that I tried to, in the compositions and in the performing, tried to think about the core emotional content of each of the poems rather than reacting to the description on the surface.
Yeah, and it, that's why it works for me, because the music doesn't overtake the poetry, but it's still very, very musical.
Well, I'm so glad you think so. That's something that we really wrestled with, all of the collaborators, and it is truly a collaborative project, both in the compositions and in the performances and in the recording, mixing. At every stage, we really were combating, well, we don't want it to sound like a book's on tape, so we don't want the music to be subservient to the words. We want there to be a synergy, but we also don't want the words to be covered up, because why have words if the words are covered up? So it was a really, really difficult balance, and we really struggled with that a whole lot.
Were you surprised at how well it was accepted or acknowledged, the Volume 1?
Wow. Yes, absolutely. The I knew that it was a difficult project when it comes to radio play, because it doesn't really fit a standard category. I had a lot of record companies say, no, we wouldn't touch poetry with a 10-foot pole, different things like that. So the fact that it's done as well as it has just blows my mind. It really does. And I think it speaks volumes to the resonance that Philip's poems and his reading have with listeners. You really can't listen to when you're listening to his tracks, you don't think, oh, I'm listening to this intellectual poetry. You think, wow, here's a great storyteller. I want to see what happens in this story. So I'm absolutely thrilled. This is like a dream come true for me.
One of the things that Philip Levine says in one of his interviews is he talks about, you know, he was nationally, internationally recognized, and he said, you know, making an impression on a nation is kind of weird because that's kind of an abstract concept, but making an impression on a person is really meaningful. What was your relationship like with him on a personal level and on a creative level?
Wow, I'd never heard that quote by Levine, but it sounds like something that he would say, and I think that helps to explain maybe why when people listen to this, they feel like Phil is talking to them directly. So that's really cool. So my relationship with him was primarily professional, meaning it's not like we went and hung out a lot or anything, but we would talk about this project, we'd talk about poetry, but the main thing that Phil wanted to talk about was music and musicians. He grew up in Detroit at a time when you had people like, we went to school with people like Kenny Burrell and Tommy Flanagan, and one of his teachers at, I think it was college or was it high school, ended, you know, had played with Charlie Parker and everything. So he was steeped in the music from a very, very young age. He was an aficionado. He understood the music. And what he wanted to talk about was the time he heard Dexter Gordon or the time that he heard, you know, the first time he heard Clifford Brown. So he a lot of what our conversations were about favorite albums and favorite music.
How did you decide what went on Volume 1 and Volume 2? And did you know from the beginning there would be a Volume 2?
That's a great question. The trajectory of this project is atypical. So first, we just did a concert together. People thought that it was effective, and they kept asking when we would do it again. So we started to think about that. And then I listened to some recordings and thought, well, this, you know, maybe we should go in the studio and try a couple of these tracks. So it was an experimental process. And over the course of maybe 4 years, 3 years, 4 years, we ended up recording, I think it was 29 tracks. So when we finally decided that we were going to put this out on a CD, we tried to think, well, what would make a good set? What pieces complement each other? So we ended up coming up with 14 tracks, and it wasn't necessarily that they were my favorite tracks. It's just that they made a really good set. We also had four guest artists with us, Chris Potter, Tom Harrell, Branford Marcellus, and Greg Osby, and I wanted to get them, of course, on whatever we put out. But we didn't put out some of my favorite things on that first disc because I wanted it all to be about Phil. So the instrumentals were not included on that disc. So when disc one did really well, then we started thinking, well, let's release these other tracks and let people hear the totality of what Phil recorded with us.
Yeah, that's one thing I really appreciate on the second volume is like you have the Simple Truth version one and then you get the instrumental version because the music stands, I think, on its own as well.
Oh, I appreciate that so much because, you know, I some people were asking or suggesting that I shouldn't have both on there, but I kind of, as a listener, think it's cool to listen to the shorter track that we did to make it work with Phil and then to listen to the instrumental version of what we did. Maybe most telling is if you listen on Volume 1 to They Feed, They Lie, and that's a really short track. It's like 3.5 minutes or something. And I didn't even include the B section with Phil. There's a whole other section of the piece that wasn't included because it didn't work when we went to the studio and were doing it with him. It just didn't seem to fit with the words, but it was part of the composition. So the instrumentals, you know, something like close to like 80% longer or something like that, and you really hear the idea develop in a different way. So I'm glad you like comparing those two. I think it's fun too.
Thank you. What do you think he'd make of all this? I mean, unfortunately, he's not with us anymore, and it has to be kind of bittersweet.
You know, it really is, and there are actually two members of this project that aren't with us anymore. So Phil died, what is it, 2-3 years ago now, and Brian Hamada, the drummer, owned many of the tracks. And I didn't get to see, I was in Ghana all last year and didn't get to see him. But yeah, he died way, way, way too soon. So it is bittersweet. But at least Brian got to know about the release of Volume 1, got to hear the tracks, but Philip didn't. I think he would be overjoyed. I think he'd be really happy. He was so happy when he came into the studio and was hanging out with the band and the musicians. I think he felt like he was a kid in a china shop. He told me he'd never done a recording session with musicians before. And so he had a heck of a good time, and I think he felt like it was cool that he was sort of like a member of the band. I don't think he felt like he was the poet and we were the musicians. So I think he would have derived great pleasure from it. And I've talked to his widow about that a lot. And I'm glad that she's here with us and she can appreciate and take part in it.
You're listening to Improvisations. We're talking with Benjamin Boone, whose new recording is called The Poetry of Jazz, with Philip Levine. Looking at some of the names on Volume 2, I see Atticus Boone and Asher Boone, and I'm thinking they might be related to you. Have you done an Ancestry.com DNA test on those musicians to see? Or?
Like many musicians, like my kids are around music all the time, but I try probably to a fault not to like strong arm them into doing something. But I wanted to include them in this. Process. So I just wanted to include them and let them be part of the process and see what their old man does. So I think they had a lot of fun. They practiced really hard, and I think they sounded really good. That's French horn and trumpet.
Yeah, I love French horn is underused in music, not just jazz, but in music in general.
Yeah, and I don't know how many of your listeners remember, but I had the honor and the privilege of going to school when Mark Taylor was there. And Mark Taylor ended up going to New York and doing and playing quite a bit of jazz horn. I think he's still there. I haven't touched base with him in a while. But French horn gets a really cool color. It's not agile like a saxophone, but if you use it right, it certainly can be a great color to use, that's for sure.
And speaking of connections on this recording, it's produced by Donald Brown.
Yes. And so I went to the Monterey Jazz. We were just, before we went on air, we were talking about the Monterey Jazz Festival. So Donald was going to be playing at the Monterey Jazz Festival. I've stayed in touch with Donald since we were colleagues when I taught at University of Tennessee before I came out to Fresno. And so we reconnected. We were talking about what we were doing. I was mentioning this project. And you might know that he's done some spoken word or poetry with music projects as well. And we just got interested. I started asking him his advice on things, and he gave really wonderful advice. And, you know, he ended up being the producer of both the first volume and the second volume. And he's also producing, I don't know if it's a third volume, it's a group of completely different poets, but I was just in New York over the winter break recording with, you know, like Corker and Holt and Kenny Werner and Ben Maunder, people like that, with some other really good poets for a social justice sort of oriented project. And Donald was there producing that. So he's given fabulous, fabulous contributions to this. And he has just amazing musical insights and a sense of history and a sense of story. I'm just so honored and privileged to know him and that grateful that he lended his expertise to these projects.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing to watch the latest act of his, you know, never-ending career of surprises just turning into this world-class producer after being a world-class composer.
Absolute world-class producer. And, you know, I was at the Jazz Congress in early January when we were doing these recording sessions, and Donald was there too. They did an Art Blakey tribute. And, you know, you know Donald is a very humble guy, but you're there at the Jazz Congress and everyone's just coming up to him. And, Donald, it's good to see you. It's good to see you. You know, Winton and Branford and Terrence and Steve Turay. I mean, name it. They're all coming up to Donald, wanting to talk to him about stuff. And I actually got one of the cool things for the mixing session of Volume 1. He was producing Kenny Garrett's, the last CD, the dance one, and I got to sit in on those sessions. And so just seeing him operate, you know, with him and Kenny Garrett together when they're talking about, you know, production or sound or use of sound spectrum or mix or panning or whatever, it was just a complete, I felt like I was back in school again, but learning more than I did the first time. It was an amazing experience.
Speaking of back in school, what are your memories of Jerry Coker and the UT Music Department?
Oh, man. You know, I really look back at that time in my life as one of the most joyful and educational that I've ever had. Very long story short, I really didn't know much of anything when I entered UT, but I went there specifically to study with Jerry. And he had this wonderful way of giving you enough information to work on without completely making it so that you'll quit, and guiding you and being methodical in what you need to do. And all of these stories and lessons from him are flooding my mind right now. He was like a father figure to me and really supported me. And I don't think if I'd gone to another institution, I would have survived. I was accepted like at University of Miami, but I don't think I would have survived that because he was just so nurturing and supportive and was a absolute true mentor. So he was fabulous. And then, of course, Don Huff gave me the first opportunity to compose. When he started the studio orchestra, there was no music, so he just would read anything and gave me that great opportunity. And then, of course, Billy Scarlett, Mark Bowling, Keith Brown, I mean, all of these wonderful, wonderful people that were on the faculty. Rusty Holloway was really supportive of what I did. So I had a wonderful education, and I'm so grateful for University of Tennessee Department of Music and the jazz program. So I hope your listeners understand what a treasure is there in Knoxville. It really is incredible and amazing.
The new recording is called The Poetry of Jazz, Volume 2, Benjamin Boone and Philip Levine. Benjamin Boone, it's been a real joy to talk to you.
Oh, Todd, what a pleasure and an honor to be on your show, and thank you for the opportunity to chat with you, and thanks for all of the great things you do there in Knoxville to help the art scene and to help promote the art form of jazz. We all appreciate it all over the world.
Well, I'll keep doing it then.
Yeah, please do.
All right.